Hi everyone, I hope you're enjoying Tay Talks and glad that you're joining us today. Today's episode is with Jennifer Teeters. Jennifer and I actually met because she's my PA. She's my primary. She's my quarterback. I've been so grateful to have worked with so many incredible PAs, but Jen brings a unique perspective into the treatment of patients as a whole. And I don't mean the term holistic in terms of Eastern versus Western medicine. I mean holistic in the sense of really looking at mind, body, environment, but also I call her the queen of physical exams. I really do need to learn from her before I go to med school. I don't think I've ever seen a provider in my life, and I've seen a lot for a lot of different issues. No provider has ever done as thorough of a physical exam as Jen does every single time I see her. Everybody in the healthcare field knows that if somebody's documenting a physical exam, most of the times they didn't actually look in your ears. She does. And she's really helped me navigate a lot of personal healthcare issues in the past, I would say almost decade at this point, in a way that even if she didn't have an answer, she knew how to get you to the answer. So I just wanted to highlight her as a person, one, and two, the different options within the field, how someone like her has been able to transform their clinical practice and also use that to teach the next generation of PAs. So she's not just benefiting her patients, she's benefiting a whole generation of patients that's going to come next. I hope you guys enjoy the episode. If you have any questions for Jen or myself, as always, leave them in the comments and look forward to hearing your feedback. Enjoy. Are three things that you hope are displayed from your legacy?
Diversity, energy, fun. My energy is the way I live. I love expressing energy and fun. I'm a you only live once type of person. And then dedication towards whatever I put my mind towards. It could be towards the students, it could be towards the curriculum, it could be towards my passion, towards my partner, it could be just dedication.
Tell me about the physical exam for a second, because you're like the physical exam queen, I would say.
I'm the queen of physical exam, I tell you. My students, they love to talk about that. There's going to be times where you're burnt out in school. There's going to be times where you're burnt out clinically. And really, at the end of the day, you have to just love what you're doing. And you have to really love that you're like providing that kind of complete care for somebody and what it means to them. So students, I think, should just be prepared organizationally, time management skills. And I really think they have to look deep inside and say, do I really care about the human? And do I really want to make a difference here? Because the profession will beat you down if you don't.
I'm going to ask you a question, not for the podcast, but based on your responses. Why was Tampa in the list of do not ask about? Do people ask you questions about Tampa?
I don't know why that was in there. Been typing something in another window and accidentally.
Okay.
Yeah.
All
So
right.
you can ask me about Tampa.
That's
Absolutely.
okay. I wasn't planning on it,
Happy to answer any questions about Tampa.
I was like, oh, there must be some trauma associated with
Tampa's
this. Like,
like the
somebody's
most sweet
asked
place
her.
ever.
It wasn't on my list, but
No, I
okay.
actually love Tampa. I've lived here for like 12 years, so I'm absolutely over the moon with Tampa.
So
Absolutely.
you've seen it go from like nothing down on Water Street to what it is now. And yeah,
Absolutely.
okay.
Ghost town of the bowling alley. And I think there was a Hooters down there of
Yes.
what we called Channel Side. And it was like nothing down there. And Seminole Heights is like a neighborhood that's also been very changing over the last 12 years. So it's been an interesting development. I love it.
Where were you before Tampa?
Well, most of my life, I grew up in Phoenix, Arizona. So I would say I'm a Phoenician. But for school, I moved around a couple places. Went to Towson in Baltimore, Maryland for my undergrad, and then back to Phoenix for a little bit and worked. And then I down to Miami for graduate studies to be an athletic trainer, actually, to get my master's. Miami was interesting. It was like a hodgepodge of people. I don't know if I was really ready for a lot of culture shock yet. I was still pretty young. I didn't love it. And honestly, I kind of vowed off Florida at that point. Like I wasn't going to move to
Yeah.
Florida. And then back to Arizona again, worked a little bit, and then decided I wanted to go to PA school. And that brought me to North Carolina, Wake Forest University in like Winston-Salem for like 2 or 3 years. And then, weirdly enough, the job at USF came up for my wife. And I was like, well, I've heard a lot of good things about Tampa, so let's go check it out. And we really loved it.
Nice. Do you see yourself sticking here for forever, or do you?
I do. I mean, I hope so. You know, it's kind of one of these things where I've tried to make USF kind of that ultimate landing spot, really, of where I end up. And as long as everything else cooperates, then I plan to stay here. Of course, life always kind of throws you some curveballs, but I don't foresee any curveballs in my future.
I like that. What got you into athletics?
I am just like every definition of a sports junkie. I played college basketball, played all sorts of sports in high school, and then I just stuck around sports for so long that when I was playing college basketball, there was like an athletic trainer who would help with injuries. I just remember thinking, God, what a cool job. Like, this person gets to travel with the team and really be associated with like sports and also treating injuries. So I just stuck with athletic training because it kept me associated with sports. And for so long, I really loved the field. And then just as you develop, I think as a clinician, you just, for me, I have like this, I would say like professional curiosity about the body, where it was like, I kind of felt like I wanted to know more and just understand, you know, like heart arrhythmias. I had a couple of student athletes who had a arrhythmia called Wolf-Parkinson-White and Brugada syndrome, and they were disqualified from participating. And I was kind of like, you know, what the heck is this? And it really kind of stemmed like this really curiosity about the heart. And we had this PA actually who would do sideline coverage with me on Friday night football games. An athletic trainer at a high school. And he was just super encouraging. And he just was like really positive about the PA profession. And I was a little older. So I was like going on 30 years old. And I was kind of like, I don't know, I'm too old to go back to school.
Yeah.
He was just like, no, you're not. You know, it's 2 years. Like, just do it. And
yeah.
So he kind of encouraged me. And I was like, really also excited to kind of stay in that medical field that first developed from the sports love and, you know, doing all that. Just kind of that background work, because it was funny. The partner that introduced me to athletic trainer, she actually turned out to be an orthopedic surgeon, right? So
really,
she was in med school. And I remember thinking, I don't think I'm equipped to be able to do that mentally or like, you know, knowledge base. I just didn't believe in my academic prowess.
At the time.
Yeah, I didn't. I really didn't. So I kind of was a little like, do I think I can make it in PA school? Kind of just challenging myself a little bit and thinking, I don't know. But I was a little more mature at that point. I was ready to take on that journey. And it was really fun. I had a great time in PA school.
What was your favorite part about being an athletic trainer?
Let's see. There's so many parts, but I would say just getting to stay around sports, just in general, having that background where it's like, I felt like I really loved to go to work every day. Also, I ended up working at a high school, and high school students are really to work with because they're, you know, they're just so young and you can be like a big mentor towards them. They, you know, they ask you a lot of questions and, you know, they believe a lot of crazy things sometimes and they're just really entertaining to work with. So that's kind of why I landed at the high schools, because I really liked that patient population. I did some athletic training at University of Maryland with the football team, Division I stuff. But it was like at that point, it felt so like a grind and just was so much. It's very high level athletes. And I wanted to have more involvement as the sole provider. And that's really why I pursued high school. And so I was the head athletic trainer at a high school. And I really liked that autonomy, loved the patient population and being associated with sports. It was so much fun to go to work, really. I taught a sports medicine class. High school started doing those courses like a HOSA organization where you can pursue medicines. I was able to teach the sports medicine classes. So that even helped my income, but it also really helped me be a mentor towards these students. It was really fun.
I love that. Do you miss playing, or did you ever regret not going down the student athlete part as opposed to the trainer part?
Yeah. I mean, you know, it's like I played college basketball and I felt pretty fulfilled with that. After that, I took a long hiatus, because that's when I then pursued being an athletic trainer. I moved to Tampa, actually, after graduating from PA school. I actually began participating as an adult athlete, as a player, the a women's professional tackle football team that we have here in Tampa.
Oh, fun.
Yeah, it was great. It was just fun to be back on the athlete side. And I did that for probably 6 or 7 years. Obviously, I sustained some injuries because I'm a little older. But, you know, it was such a good like opportunity to kind of be back in the swing of like athletics and a competitive team. And I kind of retired from playing when I was 40.
Okay.
And over the last like 6 years, I've just been volunteering my time to do the medical services for that team.
Okay.
Yeah. Cool. So it's like I get to fulfill that athletic training role. It kind of came full circle, right? So
yeah.
I'm their athletic trainer for their season, which spans about 6 months of the year. It feels very rewarding for me for women's sports just in general. I think women's sports is very important and critical, and it's completely worth my time and effort. And so it's been really cool.
I love that.
Yeah.
You are insanely busy. I can tell.
Yeah.
Tell me about how you came up with the niche clinic that you have, right? Describe that a little bit, because I don't think a lot of people listening would know what kind of clinic you have and how you got to that.
Absolutely. So I work at a family medicine clinic. I worked as a full-time primary care provider in family medicine for 5 years. And then I really pursued my passion, which was to be an educator. You know, I wanted to be an educator from the first day of PA school. Again, that's kind of like building off that high school teaching I was doing. And I really loved teaching the students. And so I was just, you know, first day of PA school, really enamored by the instructors and what they were doing and how smart they seemed. And I just was like, wow, I want to do that one day. In order to do that, you really have to be well-versed to me in medicine. You have to see a lot. And so I really explored that field of family medicine to be very versed with my background and just knowing a lot about medical conditions, because, again, that's really why I chose to be a PA. I didn't want to go actually into orthopedics. One would think that that's where I'd land, but
No.
I really wanted to take it in an opposite direction. So working full-time as a family med primary care just gave me such a huge like knowledge background. It was really great. Got to know the whole just system in general and got to have a very large patient panel at USF. And I worked, you know, every day,
mm-hmm.
2 clinics a day.
And oh my gosh.
It was busy.
Yeah.
Very busy. And in fact, it felt maybe a little burnt out, I think, after 5 years. So it was refreshing when I started to see USF develop a PA program, because I thought,
mm-hmm.
well, what a perfect opportunity for me to then transition into what I really want to do, which was to be an educator. And so when the PA program was looking for a faculty, I joined them about 6 months after their inaugural class.
Okay.
They had already been through the creation stage of the program, and just doing that, I expressed my desire to like stay clinical and to stay current and to work with our second year students who are in the clinic. And we just came up with 1 day a week still working clinically. And I think it was a really good match. My FTE allotment is 80% education and then 20% clinical.
Nice.
That really, really well, I think, because I, you know, get to do those things that I'm really passionate about. Like I'm a very outgoing person. I don't know if you can tell, but I really like to talk to people and I like to be involved in like their healthcare and like, you know, keeping their lifestyle active. It allowed me to also work with our second year students and that almost full circle moment, because I see them obviously the first day that they walk into PA school and I get to work with them their entire first year. And then now they're in clinic with me and they're seeing my patients and they're kind of giving me their treatment plan. And it's a really neat process and it's super rewarding, I think, emotionally to see that. So I think I just really love to do it. It's certainly busy. I would say I have a busy life because you know, through Thursday, I'm directing the first year of the PA program. And then Friday, I mean, you know, I don't know who works full day Friday anymore, but I do.
Yeah.
You know, and I end up walking out of that clinic sometimes at 5:30, 6, you know, 6:30 even. And I think I'm tired. Yeah, but it's rewarding in so many other ways that I don't think I'd want to stop doing it.
Is there a specific mentor or professor during your education at any stage that kind of inspired you to create this model for yourself, or was it entirely defined on your own?
No, there was a little bit. You know, at Wake Forest, we had several faculty members who still had a clinical assignment, and I just thought it was really neat that they were able to practice, and then they would come in and be able to kind of give us some historical perspective of like the patients that they saw that week, some stories. And I really liked that like hybrid type of approach that they had with the faculty. Gail Curtis actually was a faculty member, one of the primary faculty members at Wake Forest. A couple of years after I graduated, she actually ended up being the leader of the whole PA profession. She was my mentor, and it was really neat to see like how she was really leading the entire organization. I mean, even to this day, you know, I ask her to be a reference and, you know, things like that. It's just her leadership, the way that she was able to hold herself, just so many things that I wanted to just bring on my personality and like adapt what I was doing just to kind of mimic how I felt like I thought about her so professionally. Was I just thought she was such a great example. And it was, I think, a good example. And the other person I would say is actually our didactic year director, Eric Grant. I can't say enough about him. He was just such a pleasant, positive influence, knowledgeable. I still to this day stay connected with him. He was also just such a great example, I think, to learn. So, you know, and then if we roll it to USF, actually, you know, fast forward to that. Honestly, I work with a coworker of mine. His name is Larry Collins. He is, I would say, the poster child of what we call the USF PA.
Okay. You know,
he really has been instrumental in advocating for PAs at USF. He's a super positive, you know, optimistic type of guy, great coworker, and I would say just influential in my career, really. You know, every step of the way that I've had some advancement at USF, Larry Collins has kind of been there in my corner and really kind of championed my efforts. And I can't say enough about him. You know, him and his wife, who works in the medical program as well, it's just, they've just been really positive, I would say, influential people in my life. And I would, you know, call him my mentor, really. He would hate that I called him that, because like, that was the guy, you know, but
those are the best ones, right?
Yeah, exactly. If you call the USF PA program and you say, you know, hey, I just want to talk to somebody and I want to get some information, Larry Collins is the guy that's going to call you back, and he's going to, you know, really talk about any aspects of the PA profession. And he's just a really positive guy to be around.
I love that. It's always nice when you meet people organically and then, you know, things just kind of roll from there, because it feels very natural and it feels very real, right?
Absolutely. Yeah, he was the really example at USF of the hybrid athletic trainer PA, which is really how I formed a relationship with him, is because I met with him even before I worked at USF, and I was just like, I'm an athletic trainer now, PA, and I just kind of want some advice. And even after that meeting, I felt confident enough to put in my application to family medicine, and things just really took off from there. So he was, again, when I say influential, really every step of the way, he's really been in my corner the whole time. So, and now also in the education program with me, and he was there prior to me joining the education program. And so, you know, he was on the hiring committee, and it just was like so amazing to kind of see like, wow, I didn't even know Larry was, you know, part of it. It was really great.
What is the key thing that you look for in a student that you think you would not be able to succeed without?
Time management, I think, and just organizational skills. What we find with like high performing students, it's not so much your ability to learn and retain information. Sure, that's important, and high performing students are great and all of the things. What I've found is that what is key and uniform across those students is that they have good organizational and time management skills. They know how to budget. You know, I need this time to focus on my mental health. I need this time to focus on studying for this course. They're prepared. They really look at their schedule and really divvy out the time I think to prepare academically for a test or an exam or even just patient encounters. It's like they just have a knack at being organized. I've just found that that is really the overriding skill set that really, to me, is at the forefront of a lot of our very successful students. You know, certainly you don't have to be a super outgoing extrovert type of person. You also need to care about people. I think that's the really important factor that, you know, you have to like live it. You have to care about people and their well-being, because there's going to be many times, it's going to happen daily, it's going to happen weekly, where you have to go out of your way a little bit to get that refill sent or to see that patient who maybe arrived late because of maybe a circumstance that wasn't, you know, of their own. Or do a follow-up phone call with a patient who really seemed like they might need it. And so that care can, I just think it's at the forefront of everything, because there's going to be times where you're burnt out. There's going to be times where you're burnt out in school. There's going to be times where you're burnt out clinically. And really at the end of the day, you have to just love what you're doing. And you have to really love that you're like providing that complete care for somebody and what it means to them. So students, I think, should just be prepared organizationally, time management skills. And I really think they have to look deep inside and say, do I really care about the human, you know, and do I really want to make a difference here? Because the profession will beat you down if you don't. And, you know, really kind of say, oh, I care. But really, at the end of the day, all of those opportunities to do that extra mile, to take that extra step, are you, you know, seizing those opportunities, or are you kind of just saying, you know, I don't have time to kind of get this done?
What's been the most difficult case you've had to treat?
Not a particular patient comes to mind, because again, I don't like to look at patients like you're a difficult patient to treat, and this is really taking me. And I think USF, just in general, it's a large medical organization. We're partnered with Tampa General. That just in general brings highly complex patients to our doorstep, right? And we're family medicine. So these patients come to established care and there's a multiple history of disease. There's multiple hospitalizations in the past. And I think it's the continuity of care that's the most important factor for these patients, right? So as family medicine, you have to take the look at all of these specialists. You have to coordinate that care with them, because of course, you're not going to be able to treat every single complex medical condition they have. But you can certainly make recommendations. You can kind of have oversight of their medication management and how is that going. And so when it comes down to complex things, we get a plethora of it at USF. And it's a challenge for me mentally when, I guess, knowledge, where I walk into a room and if I feel like I'm like a little overwhelmed by the number of disease processes, the number of specialists, I think those are the really challenging cases that you have to really like focus. You have to actively listen at what's going on with the patient and how can you best help. And I would say that like you also get the most reward out of those patients, because if you do a good job, if you make differences, one, that patient becomes more healthy or better optimized, you might feel rewarded in that they might send you a family member because they say, oh, I've been so happy with your care, and just that positive affirmation, you know, it makes you feel like you're doing something that is really valuable when you have that really complex patient and then you get that positive affirmation, or they're doing better, or, you know, maybe they had a bump in the road where they had something happen, an acute flare of something, and you're able to really like coordinate a lot of that specialist care and make sure they're okay while they're in the hospital. It's like those types of encounters are just super rewarding. The other encounter that kind of comes to mind is just those acute life-threatening conditions that you recognize and that you can walk into a room and say, this is not right. This is scary. There is the potential of something life-threatening happening here, and that you triage care appropriately and that you solve that problem, or at least help diagnose that problem, like in a very efficient and fast way. You know, I'm thinking of like a case where I had where it was like a pulmonary embolism that I was just like, wow, this is not right. You know, patient's walking in and I'm immediately triaging it and we're getting her to the hospital. So like those cases are, you just feel so proud of yourself. This is awesome that I was able to recognize, like, thank God I had good training here. And because that could have went in a totally opposite way. And if I was not paying attention to some of the really critical signs of the patient. So
yeah. I think the role of the PA and I think how we define a PA is changing a lot, right? You operate a pretty independent practice. And I think that's not something that people immediately think of. I know a lot of people say, historically, I would say, and like as somebody who wanted to go to med school, people say, well, what, you can do PA instead. And for me, it was always those are two distinct roles and they serve different purposes in some ways, right? Like for me, I want to go into academia from a drug development space. So it wasn't, this is instead of this. And I would love to change that narrative, right? I'm sure you more than anybody would love to change that narrative of like, one is instead of the other, or this is like a pre to that. So how do you approach teaching people about that and then educating, I guess, your patients and the public on what is a PA and how does somebody recognize, okay, these are skills that I have and this is the path that I want in healthcare as its own unique entity, I would say.
Yeah. And I think what you first have to do is you have to look at the history of how the profession developed. You know, these were trained army medics coming back from war who had all of the extra skills that they learned. And, you know, they were medical providers at the time. They didn't necessarily need to go back to medical. And so what they wanted to do at Duke was actually the first program. And Eugene Stead was the person that kind of brought the profession to visibility. But you know, it was like, okay, we can offer this accelerated curriculum to these already knowledgeable people. And it is truly the medical model, right? So it's medical school that's compacted. So, you know, those army medics were able to successfully, you know, get through the curriculum in, I can't remember if it was I'm pretty sure it was a 24-month program or what have you. There's like an 18-month, 24, and then a 36-month type of program, but really kind of get this accelerated training to now go out and serve what we targeted at the time is just an underserved population. Patients who do not have access to physicians, maybe a population that really needs that extra healthcare, that needs a clinician to kind of come in and offer the ability to diagnose and to treat. And so that is really the whole nature of the PA profession. Now, over the, I would say decades, you know, keeping in mind, we are still kind of a young profession. Medical school's been there for a long, long time. So now how do you start to transform the profession to start to meet the needs of everyday life now in the decades that change? How does the profession morph and change a little bit? And so I think our goal still is to make sure that any underserved population still has clinician accessibility. That's the underpinnings really of the profession, and it still remains that. However, we start to now see PAs in specialty care, right? So we work autonomously, like you said, and we can really augment that role with the physician where we can offload quite a bit of their work in, let's say, seeing patients clinically, and maybe they're taking the surgery approach. We can be a first assist in surgery. And so you can team up and work with a physician to really tackle a patient panel. You know, you've got hundreds of patients that need care. I mean, so it really offsets the extra burden that's placed on the physician because, again, we're trained under the medical model. We have that experience that we need in order to carefully evaluate and recognize and diagnose and treat those conditions. Now, is it a research heavy field? No, it's not. Certainly more geared towards the clinician, like the practicing clinician. We do have our arm in education, but really the whole, again, the underpinnings of the career is really just to focus on the clinician side of things. So you don't see heavy research emphasis.
Right.
Now, certainly, can we conduct research? Yes. Can we emanate and read research? Absolutely, because we need to use it towards patient care. But you typically don't see a ton of people getting this clinical degree and then going into the research field, because they've kind of targeted that profession to really kind of be a clinician. And so they might pursue the other avenues to kind of explore the research field. But you can pursue having a PhD after doing PA school. There's even like a doctorate of medical science that you can pursue. So there's avenues to get into research, but you're correct in that that's not where we hang our hat on. But certainly there's always avenues. And again, the field itself is growing. And so it's the U.S. News and World Report. For several years, it was the number one growing profession. I think now it's in the top five. So it's just a huge interest in the field. And so I think just with that interest, you're going to see it go in a lot of different directions. I mean, even at USF, for instance, I would say I was probably one of the first 10 PAs hired at USF. Now, our network of PAs, and not only PAs, I would say nurse practitioners as well. You know, I don't want to discount all APPs, right? Advanced practice providers, nurse practitioners, PAs. USF has a huge network now of APPs, and PAs are a part of that. And now we've seen the network of PAs just grow and grow and grow. It's interesting to kind of see us taking off at a university or in a system that we were not present already. I love the support our graduates are getting out of school and getting hired at USF. They're getting hired at TGA. And there's just all of these great things that people have to say about them. And it's really great to kind of see them in their field, and they come back and they help us in the education program. And it's just a really neat network, I think, that we're starting to see.
I think, like you said, the clinician heavy role that you guys serve is something that I almost think that getting to kind of integrate the PA programs with the med students and teaching a little bit of reverse teaching or like cross teaching in that sense would really benefit the clinicians and the physicians on the other side. Maybe even from personal experience, I would say, especially for those who have been in practice for a long period of time, I feel like that's where they almost need to kind of shadow a PA and see how is it that you actually treat a patient day to day, right? Because there's a little bit of that disconnect that can happen sometimes. I know in our practice, that's something that's really nice because every physician has one or two PAs that work directly with them. And so the patients see both of them at this, you know, at different visits, and you get direct feedback from the patients on, hey, like, so-and-so did this, why are you not doing this? And then that kind of is like a check in real time.
Absolutely. It's just as seamless as having two physicians on your team where, you know, one physician is seeing a patient this time, and then the next time they rotate and they see another physician, and you're kind of going back and reflecting on their notes. You're asking the patient, and you're just, again, it's that real time feedback where, you know, we're making medical decisions just kind of the same. Of course, there is certainly specific roles that physicians need to fill. You know, we're not surgeons, right? And and when it kind of comes down to those specific areas of specialty, the advanced training that physicians get in residency and then fellowships, you know, start to get that real specialized knowledge in that particular field, which we as APPs can learn from, right? Like we get hired as, you know, in hematology oncology, and we've had our 2 years of education, but certainly we're not near the level of the attending or even the fellow, right? So it's really helpful to kind of get that team approach where you're learning a lot from your fellow clinicians. You're taking a lot of the knowledge and you're able to then apply it towards the patient panel together. And then you yourself are becoming now more knowledgeable in that area of specialty. The PA profession allows that ability to grow in a field and adapt to specialized knowledge. Now, are we going to have that walking into the door like you would an attending physician? No, we won't. And so we'll kind of need that extra you know, year to 2 years to kind of really start to get up to speed for those areas of extreme specialty. But it's nice that we can enter that field, right? That we can be an autonomous provider in that field. And I think the very last thing that some of the PA profession offers is that part of me likes this ability to have that lateral mobility across fields. If I'm doing hematology and I'm like, wow, this is just not something I'm really fitting, or I'm just not understanding, I do have that ability to then switch my job classification to now maybe I want to do nephrology. And so it's not as easy, I think, as some people make it seem. Like if I'm doing dermatology, I can switch.
Yeah, I can just jump.
It's not that easy, right? It's once you choose an area of specialty, you become very siloed into that one area of specialty. And so to then switch fields into a different area of specialty, it requires a lot of extra attention towards the knowledge base that you've made possibly ignoring for the last, you know, 3 to 5 years for an area of specialty. So when I hear students, this is a bit of a talking point for me, is when I hear students say, well, I chose PA because it offers that lateral mobility. And if I don't like that area of specialty, I can change. And I think it's not that easy. Sure, there is that ability to do that. But that's why I always kind of coach my students into going into things like outpatient, just general care, gen med, internal medicine, family emergency room. You really should get 5 years under your belt of general medicine before you decide, I'm going to now go into this area of specialty. Okay. Maybe I didn't like that area. Now you can fall back on those 5 years that you had developed. And then we choose a different area of specialty. And so, you know, with the new graduates that just immediately enter an area of specialty, I think if it's not a generalized area of medicine, I do think they actually almost diminish that ability then to be able to really.
That's a great piece of advice.
Yeah. It's one of my big talking points, really, in the young student really kind of seeing that offering. And you're like, oh, okay, well, I can change career path. And you have to really talk it through, and they have to really understand the implication of what that means.
Yeah, that's a big one. I think the biggest thing that people advertise PA as, right? Like, you can switch. And I love that you're reframing that. You can, but let's get a good basis first, and then we can go from there.
I think that is actually one of my biggest pet peeves of interviewing, is when I hear that as one of the first reasons why they chose being a PA.
Oh, you're like, oh God.
I don't want to say cringy, but it's almost to the point where, tell me other reasons why you want to be a healthcare provider, right? Like, not because I can change my mind.
Every patient wants to hear that, right?
Yes, right. I want to hear so many other things other than the lateral mobility.
Yeah.
And to really understand what that actually means, I think is really important. And I think I'm super impressed with students or applicants who can reflect on that and who actually can like give me that approach and say, I really think I would like to stay general, right? That's what the PA profession is for. And I would like to kind of decide, okay, I really liked nephrology. In family medicine, I can tell you right now, I love the field of rheumatology. I absolutely do. I think it's an interesting field. I feel very equipped to be in that field. I could safely transition into the field of rheumatology. But this is me reflecting on my 12th year in family medicine, right? Could I also maybe go into the field of cardiology? Absolutely love cardiology. But that's the offering, right? Like I've kind of developed this very wide base of knowledge. And now I can kind of say, okay, I can just kind of take whatever the world gives me that we talked about in the beginning, you know, I can kind of take a curveball now, and I can kind of go any field I'd like to go with at this point in my career. But it's just really important for me to emphasize that to new applicants as well.
Do you think that your career in athletics or specific things from your training as an athlete have impacted your model, your style for teaching and treating patients?
Yeah, oh, absolutely. I think just having an understanding of anatomy is critical to understanding the whole basis of where disease can happen and why it happens. And I think anatomy and physiology is like at the crux of so many disease processes, and having that extra emphasis in athletic training for, you know, the 6-7 years I was full-time in the field, having that anatomical background, that extra emphasis in the joints and all of the attachments and insertion points of muscles and tendons and ligaments, and, you know, just really understanding anatomy to the nth degree for me has been extremely beneficial. And, you know, I don't think I would be the PIA that I am now without having that experience, right? And having come into the profession already having that ability to take a medical history from a patient and, you know, conduct a physical exam, albeit that it was mostly orthopedic in nature, but certainly just that 6 or 7 years that I got to be able to talk to patients, it just leapfrogged me in my ability to take everything that the PA profession's teaching me and kind of build on it. It was just a really strong foundation for me to kind of build on. So it absolutely has helped me in so many areas. And it was about 4 years ago, maybe 3, I decided to take on the rheumatology content of our curriculum program. And it was a deep dive into understanding the immune process and how it works. And it's just been really great for me to kind of have that. The curriculum itself, just being an educator, helped reinforce my knowledge, but also diving into the rheumatology field, autoimmune in nature, it's also helped my clinical career in family medicine. It's like those little, and then my background of musculoskeletal coming into play there, it just really accelerated like my knowledge of autoimmune conditions. And it's been a really fun module to direct, and I just absolutely love it.
Tell me about the physical exam for a second, because you're like the physical exam queen, I would say.
I'm the queen of physical exam. I tell you, my students, they love to talk about that. They really feel a lot of pressure to report on the physical exams. Like, the historical perspective there is that I've been teaching the physical exam course for the PA program for the last 5.5, 6 years. And I teach every aspect of it. So I teach the history taking, I teach the clinical reasoning, how to write a SOAP note. And then I venture into every single organ system, starting with vital signs, dermatology, skin, hair, nails, cardio, pulm, abdomen, you know, peripheral vascular. It's just on and on and on. I just feel so very passionate about the physical exam of a patient and how many signs are uncovered of a disease process if you just are careful and knowledgeable about how diseases present with the signs that they present with. And if you're just kind of paying attention, if you're doing the physical exam that comes along with those conditions, you can just uncover so many like clues into like a diagnosis. And so yeah. I love it.
I think I have to sit in on your, are you teaching it in the summer?
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. We're okay. Actually, I teach it, I think on coming this Wednesday, I teach the head, ears, eyes, nose, and throat.
Can I come sit in on a class? Oh my gosh. Okay.
Absolutely. Anytime, you know.
I need to get all my training before I start med school, right? Like, I need that, that training from you.
It's really, it's great because, you know, keeping in mind that everything that I do lecture-wise is from an entry-level standpoint, right? I'm not advanced training of physical exam, but I'm doing as an entry level, you know, clinician, you know, a first year med student, a first year PA student. These are the, you know, techniques that you have to start to learn how to do on the patient, the maneuvers, and how to actually interpret them correctly. So you might do a maneuver and you have no idea what the actual positive finding would be. And so it's a journey that I take with them from the moment that they get into school until the end of their first year. They have physical exam pretty much that entirety of the time, and it's just so much fun. And then when they get into clinic, it's funny when they come out of the patient room and they're always like, okay, I remember. Because I'm always like, what is this?
Yeah, like, I love that.
I have to know how to report back to me.
How you want to hear it, yeah.
Yeah, you know, it's just so important. And I think it's one of those things that as the diagnostics are developed in our society, the chest x-rays, the CT scans, the MRIs, the, you know, even one of my other passion, point of care ultrasound. But even as those diagnostics develop, we tend to rely on them more. And our intuition and our feel in our ears and our senses, right? If you just kind of tune in those sensory organs, you can really uncover a lot of information.
I love that. What's your biggest pet peeve in charting?
In charting?
Like when you're reading somebody else's note.
I think a poor plan.
Okay.
Because what I really want to do is I want to close the loop for a patient, or I want to be able to jump off to the next step for a patient. And if I go and look at a previous office note, either from myself or their clinician, and I don't understand what happened in the previous visit, I'm spending time like rehashing some of the things that I could have already learned from just a little more explanation in the plan. And so sometimes when I see a plan that's just not thorough or not explanatory, I kind of think, huh, I'm kind of left with some questions here. And I would probably say that is my biggest pet peeve for sure, because you only have 20 minutes, 15 minutes with a patient. And so you have to be able to make the most of that time. If you're having to go back and rehash some things and answer some questions, sometimes it can eat up a chunk of that time for sure.
What's the hardest thing that you've been through in life? Personal, professional, that you think really shaped who you are and how you make decisions?
I think two real character builders for me was just participating in team sports. Teams are great. They can be problematic for some people, but they really require you to dedicate yourself to something that's not just you. It's about the team. Mm-hmm. It's about development. Unselfish tendencies and those types of things. So just participating in team sports throughout my life has been really instrumental in just kind of developing those skills. Secondarily, PA school. It's hard to explain, but the speed at which information is to you and the ability for you to process and retain it and then utilize it all on it. It is so fast and it is so rigorous that your brain is just almost spinning for 2 years of your life. And it is 100% dedication. It is making those sacrifices that you otherwise wouldn't make. Examples would be your weekend time, right? We love everybody loves weekend time because we kind of mentally check out, right? And we're kind of like, okay, I need a break from work or I need a break from this. And weekend time is really where you have to dial it in PA school, because you have to take those extra 48 hours that you're given and you have to now process that information and try to retain it and then, you know, try to utilize it for exams and for patient encounters. And it just comes so fast that if you take a beat, if you take a day and you don't dedicate yourself to something and you're like, you know what, I'll get to it tomorrow, you have lost ground and it is emotionally taxing. And, you know, you're always feeling like an imposter. You're just like, I'm not good at this. I'm not the one that should be here. And so that was character building. I'm telling you, it was a lot to get through and extremely hard. And now me being on the flip side of things now where I'm the educator in charge of the curriculum, I can still reflect on those challenges and try to do the best that I can to ease that mental, emotional tax. And that the well-being of our students, I think, is just one of the very most important things for me. Certainly, listen, I've got things I need to do as the director, right? there's things you need to learn. There's things that I cannot simply just decide to give you the afternoon off. So there's give and take on both sides. But I think having gone through that, I can recognize when a student might be struggling with their mental health or with their well-being and saying, hey, why don't we get you out of class today and get you over to the counseling center or, you know, something that can help kind of ease their unrest. But there's no substitute for hard work. And it was hard work. Yeah,
I think for me, and I don't know how you approach it with your patient, your students, is it's a period of time and it's going to be over, right? Like reminding yourself that it's not forever. This is just what you have to get through right now. That helps sometimes get through some hard things. Not always, but sometimes.
No, it literally is that there is a light at the end of the tunnel. Mm-hmm. You are saying yourself, okay, you know, and this is a year of didactic where you're in the classroom. This is a year of my life. I do this, you know, the weekends that you have to tune in and every weekend you're like, okay, that's just another weekend down. I feel myself getting smarter. I know that things are happening, you know, and you have to feel that reward to give all of that extra time and effort. And you do, you start to really feel it. You start to know that you're making progress and you know that there really is a next chapter. Right. You're right. Like, okay, for the next chapter, now I'm going to use what I'm learning and I'm going to go see patients my second year.
Yeah.
Real patients, like actual people with actual problems.
Yeah.
I want to like put this all into practice. And so that's the next chapter for our second years. And then you're kind of like, okay, you're getting comfortable with this and you're getting, you know, better at your skills. And then something hits you towards the end of your second year. And that's pure terror about now you being the clinician and you being the one that is ultimately in charge of all the decisions, and you start to really feel inadequate. And then you're like, oh, I don't know if I'm ready to do this. You're kind of looking forward to the chapter's ending and you're like, okay, well now I have the certification exam I have to pass, which you guys all understand, the step exam.
Yeah.
And then you're like, oh my gosh, okay, I passed, but now it's me. Now I'm the clinician. Now I'm the provider. And you're a different level of just unrest comes into your life. And then again, every year, it's almost like a turning a chapter, you know, you're like, okay, I'm starting to get better at this. And you know, things start to change.
What's a ritual you have that helps you protect your personal time?
Oh, I have a ritual. It immediately comes to my mind because I do not compromise it.
Okay.
That I do not take work home. And I'm talking clinical work. When I was a full-time provider, I would see my patients and I would do my notes that day. And I would clear my inbox that day. And I would sign everything. I had a process where I would leave one note open and I would get there at 6:30 the next morning. And I would do that note and I would clear my inbox. And it was a ritual for me where I have to get all of my notes done while I'm in clinic, because what I want to be able to do is when I leave clinic, because I didn't have call. So I would leave clinic and I would want to leave my work at work, and I would want to be able to come home and just disconnect from work and enjoy my personal life, my dog, my partner, like conversations. And so for me, it was a complete non-negotiable. But what that ended up doing, and you're going to appreciate this at some point, is it's easy to negotiate that, meaning I'll just do these, or I'm tired, I've had a long day, I'm just going to not do these notes and come at them a different time. Maybe I'll come at them over the weekend.
Yeah.
And it just, your life is already busy. And if you continually make that compromise, you'll find that you're going to make it more and more. And then you're doing notes on the weekend. Then you're doing notes at home. And then you're sacrificing your quality time or your personal life. And so, yes, it makes for a longer day because, of course, at the end of the clinic, when I could be leaving after patient care, I stay there and I did my notes.
Yeah. Yeah.
That would add enough. Hour and a half to my day, depending upon the notes, sometimes 2 hours. So
yeah.
And it was hard. I still to this day on Fridays, that is what keeps me sometimes till 6:30, is that I'm doing my notes. Because when I leave there, I'm on weekend, you know, I'm on the holiday.
Yeah.
I don't want to think about it.
Yeah.
So yeah. And of course, you know, if there's like an urgent lab that comes in, I have to, of course, be, you know, ready to deal with that. They're far between, right? So, but yeah, that is a ritual that I never compromised. And I just found that it was my only way to separate the two.
Yeah.
And really that relief.
I love that. I think that's, and you're right about like, if you ignore it, or if you compromise once, twice, three times, like that piles up. Because you're still going to see patients the next day, and you're still going to have more notes the next day. And then you're going to, even if you prioritize those today, you're not going to get the ones from yesterday done. And so it's similar to the whole, okay, school's going to be over in 2 years. The day is going to be over when the day is over, and then you can move on, right? It's an extra hour, but then you're done.
Right, right. And it's tough because, man, there's days sometimes when you are just tired and you just want to go home. And I get that. And, you know, you can make those decisions. That's okay. If those days happened for me, I would just make the decision that I'm not doing those notes today, and that tomorrow be longer that I have to stay because I'll have to catch up those notes. It's not that I would say, I'm not going to do these notes now. Maybe I'll log in later and do them. It was either all or none. And so most of the time, obviously, I would be staying. And for me, I was able to get notes done way quicker when I was in the clinic because my primary focus is just notes, you know, whereas at home, that same note would take me usually 5 to 10 minutes longer. And if you have 18 notes, it's a change of responsibility and time.
Okay, rapid fire. What's something in lecture that you swear by, like a prop? Is it a board? Is it a skeleton? Is it a clicker? What's that?
Eye contact.
Eye contact. Okay, I feel like that. Fastest way to lose your attention in a meeting.
My attention or students' attention?
Your attention.
My attention. Bring a dog into the room. I am just...
That's it. You're done.
I'm immediately converted to the dog.
I think that's normal. That's okay. What's a topic you could teach tomorrow? Zero prep.
Rheumatology.
Okay. Last book you read for fun.
Oh, Lord. I don't read for fun.
Okay.
I mean, this goes way back to like... maybe the Twilight series? I don't even know.
Oh my
know.
God. Like, okay. All right. Never mind.
I don't read for fun.
Are you a movie really buff don't. Or are you a TV show? Okay. Yeah. Last movie you watched.
Okay. Let's see. Just recently, I just watched the Netflix Tyler Perry movie called Straw.
Okay. All right. I have not seen that. Was it good?
It was okay. It's a journey of a woman who loses a lot of just ability to like function in a day and disassociates from her personality. And it's a really interesting movie.
Okay. All right. First app you open on your phone every morning.
Ooh, Reddit.
Reddit. Okay. Go to karaoke song.
So What by Pink.
Okay. All right. Favorite smell?
Roses.
If you could jump into any specific year that has passed, either for you or before you, what would it be?
I probably would just choose the year I graduated high school, which was 1996, a long time ago. You know, it's just, it would be fun to be able to choose maybe a different path in life, but I don't know that I would choose a different path, but it would be fun to be able to, you know, make those decisions again.
I like that. Okay, cool. And this is not rapid fire, but a little bit more thought. When you retire, there's a legacy wall at USF, I'm assuming. What are three things that you hope are displayed from your legacy?
Diversity.
Okay.
I love all sorts of things and people, and I want to be known for somebody that can appreciate diversity of everybody.
Mm-hmm.
Energy.
Yeah.
Energy is the way I live. I love expressing energy and fun and like just... I'm a you only live once type of person. Let's see how to word this, but dedication towards whatever I put my mind towards. It could be towards the students. It could be towards the curriculum. It could be towards my passion, towards my partner. It could be just dedication.
What is giving you the most hope right now?
Hope? You know, it's an interesting climate right now. I think what's giving me the most hope is seeing, and I don't mean to get political with this, but seeing society really rally together, and protest their belief system when it seemed as though that we were overrun with a particular type of belief. So seeing the opposite of that and how society is really rallying around the opposite side of that belief is mm-hmm. just really neat. People pursuing their passions and to standing up for what they believe in. And I just, it gives me a lot of hope for society in general when I felt like that hope was starting to get a little squandered.
Yeah.
Over the last, you know, year.
Yeah. No, I agree with you there. I think something I try to remind myself of a lot, and I've had to over the last more than just year, I would say like for a while now, has been the world is still spinning. And for me, that means the good outweighs the bad. And so just try to remind myself of that often. It's like, it may not be around you. You may have to find it. You may have to look for it, but there has to be a higher balance of good than bad if we're still spinning. That's kind of my perspective on that.
Well, and I think you have to intentionally seek out the good to be mindful of like your mental health and your perspective on things. And, you know, because obviously reporting is a lot of times just on bad. And so you have to really kind of look for the good. And, mm-hmm. and when I say just society coming together and standing up for what they believe in, that can mean anything, right? Like, I'm not trying to take a political side, but what I'm saying is standing up for themselves and really just pursuing like things that they really are passionate about. And like, I think that that's a really neat thing to see. And it gives me like a lot of positive affirmations about just society in general. And, mm-hmm. you know, that people do still care now, because in this social media driven climate, sometimes you just feel like your heads are buried in your phone or that you're kind of shutting out the external things that don't mean anything to you. And so having those people kind of show up for their beliefs, I think is just a really neat thing to see. And it gives me a lot of hope.
I love that. I love that. Is there anything that we didn't talk about that you would like to leave off with?
No, I just like you seem to be very passionate about this. And I really love that you have taken the next step of like getting this going for yourself and bringing like exposure to a lot of different areas of, you know, whether it be you're talking about medicine, or you're talking different fields, just offering a different platform for people to kind of hear different perspectives, I just think is a really neat thing. And I was super happy that you emailed me and I was happy to help. So,
thank you. I'm really excited. I'm excited, and I hope it goes well.
Yeah, hard work and dedication. You know, again, you're dedicated to your craft. I think it's really neat that you've kind of taken that next step. So, congratulations.
Thank you. I'm really excited. All right. Thank you so much, Jen. I appreciate it. Have a good rest of your week.
Take care.
You too. Bye.
Bye.